Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregenauer with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregen, welcoming the best audience in the entire field of psychology, psychiatry, mental health, personal growth and development, and all of that. Delighted again to be speaking to you, as I've been doing for many years now. It's really an honor and a pleasure, something I do every week and really look forward to. Now, last week I had on the air Irving Kirsch, who is a preeminent researcher in the failure of psychiatric drugs, particularly antidepressants, to help people, and also has done important research and is familiar with the research on the value of psychotherapy. And at the end of a show that was very critical of the drugs, Irving Kirsch did a really good thing and reminded us all in the last 3 minutes that there's just a ton of research on the value of psychotherapy, and by that I include couples therapy, family therapy, and also education in helping people across the range of mental struggles, from what all of us inevitably go through in life to people who have, for a time at least, really lost control over their personal experience. I'm going to have Irving back as soon as he can come, and as soon as we have an opening, to talk more about the positive aspects of research. And I want to, in terms of psychotherapy, and I want to talk about that some today. I've got a great guest today. You've heard him elsewhere. You've read his blogs on the Madness in America website. It's my friend and psychologist, Michael Cornwall. Michael, are you there?
Yes, Peter, I'm here. Hi.
Hi. Michael is someone I have on more occasionally than others for many reasons. He's a really experienced therapist. He has personal experience with the struggles to be a human being that he bases a lot of his work on. He writes really important blogs on Madness in America, where I also blog. It's a really good place. And he's a therapist who brings together the interpersonal, the existential, the whole works of being a therapist, as most of us who have been doing therapy forever do. And he has a cool job. He does workshops at Big Sur at Esalen. Now, he's becoming a bit of my go-to guy for the weirdest crap going on in psychiatry. I don't think I've ever used that word on the air before. When I had him on not long ago, and he can catch us up on this, he was talking about the FDA considering accepting a drug company proposition to market pills that would signal from your stomach to a receiver on your body, and then on to your favorite authority, whether or not you were taking your pills. And he'll catch us up on that. But he's also got some more weird stuff to tell us today about the latest in psychiatry. And this one will give you the chills, I think. But first, you agree with me that there's a large body of psychotherapy literature, and of course a tremendous amount of experience, that therapy really works, really helps people.
Absolutely, Peter. And even in the area that I've specialized in, for about 35 years of alternative approaches to psychosis or extreme states, I know your dear friend Bertram Caron, going back to the 60s, did landmark work on doing psychotherapy with people with schizophrenia label. My own doctoral research was doing therapy with people in acute psychosis without medications. There's, so in that area, there's dozens of other studies, the recent Open Dialogue work that's coming out of Finland that's really taking off in the United States that looks at medication-free or minimal medication therapeutic interventions with families and networks where someone is in a extreme state or psychosis. There's so much out there, and I'm so grateful to you for these decades of both a warning us about the dangers of some of the treatments of medications and ECT, but also highlighting that there are alternatives. I think that two-pronged approach of, you know, there's some things people need to really consider and be concerned about, but there's also good news. So working with people in extreme states over these years, I've always relied on the research and then my own experience of just knowing how when we connect with people in that empathic, compassionate way that you've always advocated, that it really works, and it works with kids. I've worked with kids all these years, too, so, yeah, there's good news.
There's a lot of studies, too, of people who are not in extreme states being helped, going all the way back to Carl Rogers with a fairly simple approach to therapy of really encouraging a positive view of oneself and giving positive feedback, even things which most of us would use only in a larger framework, like the cognitive therapy we use in a framework, I think, of interpersonal relationship and other things. Studies showing that it's effective and of course, doesn't cause all the horrible stuff that the drugs do, and the drugs can't actually prove they're effective in really any arena. So I just wanted to catch up, folks, on that. And then I want to now hand over the microphone to Michael Cornwall and let him tell us about the latest weird stuff going on aimed at children on this occasion. And we're going to talk a lot today about children and what's done to them and what they really need. So take off, my friend.
Okay. Well, as you and I both know, if we kind of read these different news stories that come along, sometimes our jaws drop when we hear some of the latest developments. And a couple of weeks ago, I saw this announcement that a new form of Adderall, which is an amphetamine substance that is prescribed for people with ADHD, mostly kids with ADHD, Adderall, that a new form of it developed by this Neos Therapeutics company has been approved by the FDA, and it's a orange-flavored, fructose-sweetened tablet that is placed on the tongue of a young child or teenager who may have in the past not liked to swallow pills with water. There's research that shows, you know, that a lot of kids have trouble swallowing pills with water, so kind of following the lead of the successful chewable vitamins, I think, you know, that kids have been taking for years, this company came up with a new form of Adderall. It's called Adzenys, A-D-Z-E-N-Y-S, Adzenys. It even kind of sounds playful, you know, Adzenys. So when I saw that now these parents, you know, who are always being marketed for the latest psychiatric drugs, will be hearing from psychiatrists, there's a new pill here that you can just put on your child's tongue each morning or give it to them to take, and it's a disintegrating, orally disintegrating pill. They don't chew it up, really. They just let it sit there, and it just, you know, they've done all this work to figure out how to have it just dissolve, and then it's a time-release pill, so it's a one-day, all-day-long release pill. And it just struck me as another way that the pharmaceutical companies are so intent on marketing, you know, their drugs. And again, let me say, like I said on your show before, you know, for people who are taking medication, I'm not in any way suggesting that they stop or that they don't hold to the diagnosis that they have, if they have one that they think is helpful. But I think these concerns that you and I have had for so long about the overuse of medication and the effects of medication, when I saw this about this new, you know, sweet candy-like Adderall, which Adderall, you know better than I do as a physician, is an amphetamine. If you Google Adderall, it says it's amphetamine. In fact, on the package, Peter, the package of every one of these Azenny's tablets, it says it's an amphetamine, 9.4 milligram amphetamine. So I just had the idea that, wow, having worked with so many parents over the years and see them struggle with to medicate their child or not, that I thought I'd write something about it and kind of ask the question that I think has been kind of a taboo discussion about why do parents give their children these drugs that you and I have real reservations about. And so I kind of came up with three areas that there, I'm sure there are more, but maybe we can discuss, like, the pressures on parents internally and externally to give their kids these meds. One we know is this enormous ad campaign that's been going on for 20 years around ADHD meds. The second is just being in the presence of a child psychiatrist and all the authority of the psychiatrist saying, your child needs to see this. And the thing that really shocked me that I heard a couple weeks ago in one of the large HMOs here in California, where a child psychiatrist reached down in his desk and pulled out a drawer and pulled out a model of a human brain and held it up to a parent while the child, the five-year-old child, was sitting on the floor. The psychiatrist had just completed an ADHD evaluation and said to the parent, now here's the model of your child's brain. The frontal cortex, the MRI scans show, are dark, and it shows what's wrong with your child's brain. So I think that chilling news coming from a psychiatrist is basically like some doctor holding up an x-ray of, you know, one of our children's broken arm or leg and pointing to the x-ray and go, look what's wrong. So I think that is a huge impact why parents give their kids meds. And then the third is just that there aren't the alternatives that you and I would hope were available.
Yeah, before going on to excuse me, reviewing all of those three, I just want to dwell on the horror and why it's so horrible that we're giving gummy bears loaded with amphetamines to children.
Thank you.
I mean, it's appalling in so many ways. First of all, it's teaching children that amphetamines are candy. We already have an increased rate of cocaine abuse in very good studies in children who grow up to be young adults and have been given amphetamines. We know that happens in animals. So, of course, it can happen in kids. It makes them more susceptible to cocaine abuse later on.
Yeah.
It, in general, gives them the idea that psychiatric drugs are candy and kind of harmless and plump them. There's already a tremendous, and this is just appalling to me, there's already a tremendous tendency for kids and even young adults in the colleges and universities to exchange drugs and have little drug parties. Well, my God, if one of them's a gummy bear, just who isn't going to want to suck on a gummy bear, a kind of a medication, without even thinking about it, be the first thing to do? And I'm sure these SOBs who develop this are really aware of how this is going to make partying with the drugs more common among younger and younger children. I mean, I can imagine a day now where 4 and 5 year olds will be exchanging their sweet little medicines. It completely covers up how dangerous the drugs are. And it gets around, and they are so dangerous. With the follow-up studies that I evaluate in psychiatric drug withdrawal, I mean, it's very clear. We've been following them now, Ginger and I, these old studies that have been going on, and now they're up in the adults are in their 40s, and they live shorter, they have more suicide. They have more incarceration. They have more mental hospitalization. They have multiple psychiatric drug use. They're more obese. They're sicker. And it's not because they just had a amphetamine, you know, for a while in childhood. It's because it became a gateway drug. And boy, this is another thing. It's going to be such an easy gateway for the parents. So I just want to interject that this there's just appalling implications to giving these kids their drugs and sweet flavors to suck on and take care of right away. I mean, it's just it's enraging. And may the may there be a hell for some of these people to face their circumstances, what they've done. Because I don't see any justice on earth in the immediate future. These people are just making money and poisoning children. It's appalling to me. So I just want to get that out there to set this in context, because this is terrifying. It's disgraceful. I don't have any words to capture what it means. Not just not that I'm appalled, that we should all be just shocked and appalled that the FDA is letting them get away with masquerading amphetamines as candy. Just a terrible, terrible thing. But Michael, pick up from there. This is just so dreadful to me.
Well, it's I'm grateful to just hear you, because I had the same reaction and of outrage and real just kind of like fear, like if this is going to happen, what's next, you know? And I got to say, I wrote that article for Mad in America and put it up, and you know, there's already been over 1,100 people have viewed it, and the comments are in the same vein you and I are talking. People are really upset about it. A lot of parents have commented and said, this is really bad. And, you know, one mother wrote and kind of anguished said, they started my child on Adderall when she was very young, and it really ruined her life. I mean, you talked about the long-term effects, you know, when some kids are started on these stimulants so early. You know, and Bob Whitaker done all the research, but you've done more than anyone on this, and it's just, you can see the evidence that it has real potential damages through teen years, college, for the rest of people's life. And I wonder if, you know, being the MD, if for the, some people I think don't realize that these stimulants, Ritalin, Adderall, I mean, Adderall, the package says amphetamine. Does everybody know what an amphetamine is? I mean, methamphetamine, as I understand it, is amphetamine. It's been methylated twice. So Adderall is an amphetamine, just in the same family as methamphetamine, right, Peter?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, methamphetamine is available at your local pharmacy to give children. That's how stupid my profession is. And I thought, well, nobody's doing that anymore, giving methamphetamine. And by golly, one of my lawsuits where I'm an expert, I come across this guy who's such a dopey guy. He's prescribing methamphetamine, and the kids are taking it, and the mother has no idea. Yes, it's so close to cocaine that it's hard to distinguish it from cocaine, other than cocaine becomes more dangerous because it's very short-acting and very punchy, so it just gives you a really sharp, hard whack, which is even more damaging and more addicting. But it's the same process. It's the same three basic neurotransmitters, and when you're over-stimulating three neurotransmitters, you're throwing the whole brain out of balance. Because it affects one after another. Wow.
Well, I was looking at the common side effects for this new Adzenys, and I'm sure that they're similar for Adderall, because it is a form of Adderall, but just so people know, here are the listed common side effects. Stomach pain, extreme mood change, vomiting, nervousness and fever. I just think it's valuable for us to be talking, and if parents are listening, that these are not kind of benign substances that they may be hearing from this child psychiatrist. But, you know, I would really hesitate to give my child something that one of the common side effects is extreme mood change.
Absolutely, and that includes suicidal feelings and actions.
Yeah.
It's also psychosis. The best study that was done at a clinic long-term in Canada, they went back and looked at all the records, and they found something nobody was noticing hardly at all about the kids, which is that 10% of them had psychotic symptoms along the way of being on these drugs.
Yeah. Yeah, there's so much to be concerned about, and that first point that, you know, you've written about more than anyone about, that I was talking about why parents maybe have been influenced to give their kids these drugs, is about the massive 20-year campaign of the drug companies to sell these ADHD drugs. From, I think, 1990, there were 600,000 kids diagnosed with ADHD, and now there are 3.5 million, and over $10 billion a year are spent on these drugs. And I read that there are 63 million prescription ADHD drug prescriptions a year now, Peter. 63 million in the United States a year.
It's just, it is just bizarre.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on now with what you had started to talk about, which is, you know, what are parents doing? What do they think they're doing? I think it's important to talk about that.
Well, I think, again, you know, loving parents, they're getting these phone calls or notes from school. We think your child may need some counseling, may need to be evaluated for ADHD, and there's tremendous pressure. I've worked in schools for years. There's tremendous pressure from the schools, from the principal on down, for parents to get their kid evaluated if there's kind of any acting up in class, in these, you know, tremendously overcrowded classrooms. Almost the knee-jerk thing now is get the kid evaluated for ADHD, which that means drugs. So there's that pressure, but also this ad campaign. I mean, the ADHD drug companies took out ads in People magazine and Good Housekeeping. The maker of Adderall, Shire, contributed to printing up 50,000 comic books, Peter, comic books with an ADHD theme with messages in it. If you take your medication, you'll be able to concentrate better. So to me, that has this real creepy kind of, I mean, you and I both know that these drug companies are shameless in their marketing, but this direct marketing of the ADHD drugs has been an enormous success. And there was an article in the New York Times by Alan Schwartz about it, where I think he rightfully said the marketing campaign has contributed to the increase from 600,000 kids to 3.5 million being diagnosed with ADHD. So I think that's tremendous pressure on the parents. Just, it's on TV, it's in the magazine, it's in Good Housekeeping. What could be so wrong? I think the second thing is
Let me interrupt there. Just add an element of history for folks. In 1972 or 3, there were U.S. congressional hearings talking about a huge epidemic of the use of these drugs, and the figures varied from 150 to maybe 200 or 300,000. I'm not sure what the upper limit was. A much smaller level. There were huge hearings about it, which we could never get now. A lot of professionals came and talked about how bad it was. And then it remained relatively static because they didn't do the avalanche of advertising until the date you mentioned, which is quite a bit after 72. What is the date that it starts getting really going again? 85?
I think so. 86? Yeah.
So there's a huge span, but there's not much rise, maybe double, and then, wow, they really go after the advertising to the child market, and you get this explosion. So there's no question that this is, all of this starts with the drug company pushing the stuff. It all starts with that. No question about it. Our colleagues, my colleagues in medicine, the pediatricians, the family docs, and worst of all, the shrinks, my colleagues, the psychiatrists, if they put their foot down, this wouldn't happen. But instead, they push it. They go along with the drug companies. They're just lackeys for the drug companies. But it all begins with that huge kind of fake research. You know, Adderall XR got approved. They studied it. They had a 3-week study to get the long-acting form of Adderall approved, a drug that kids would take for the rest of their lives, perhaps, but certainly for months and years. The FDA lets them get by in a 3-week study. And why did they do a 3-week study? Wouldn't they like a month-long study? Of course they would. But the kids get worse. Just like you were saying, Michael, they get worse. So they don't get better, they get worse. But if you can keep the study to 3 weeks, you shut down their behavior enough, because the drug crushes spontaneity, so you manage to shut down behavior for a few weeks, and you can count less behaviors and get the drug approved.
Yeah.
It's that bizarre, evil, unethical. Go on, my friend.
Yeah, well, just quickly on that point, I know you've been involved in some of the other legal actions, and they're pretty well publicized now, of drug companies manipulating the drug trials on kind of many of these psychiatric drugs. But I think the other huge factor then that comes into play of why parents give these amphetamines to their kids they love is that really the pharmaceutical companies could count on psychiatrists who came up with the ADHD diagnosis in the first place in the DSM. They could count on psychiatrists to go along with making this the standard of care and the treatment of choice. And so every time someone goes in for a problem with their child, the psychiatrist is kind of already primed by the drug companies to recommend, you know, these stimulants. And so I don't know that you'd call that collusion, but it's just kind of, it's a part of that whole disease model that sees children as potentially, you know, having these mental illnesses that are genetic and neurobiological. So I think what I'm seeing kind of face to face, you know, this is what also prompted me to write this article, are families coming in who actually then go for, you know, the ADHD evaluation with a child psychiatrist. And then, like I said, the psychiatrist reaches in the drawer now and pulls out a model of a brain and points to it and says, well, now we have the science with the MRI studies to prove it. So I think that's the second kind of powerful. Yeah,
let me say there is actually collusion. There's no question about it now. I mean, we've got it all tracked out, right, to Biederman at Harvard taking tons of money, and his whole team, the whole Harvard Child Psychopharmacology Division. I laugh because it's so stupid, a Child Psychopharmacology Division at Harvard, taking money from Johnson & Johnson, their subsidiary Janssen, to promote the diagnosis of children with bipolar disorder, a fake diagnosis, in order to give them Risperdal, a product. Recently, in one of the lawsuits I was in, one of the leading researchers who did so-called controlled clinical trials on amphetamines for children, it was actually Risperdal for children. You know, he claimed that that he had no contact with the drug company before he did these trials. They just called him after he saw his trials. And we found definitive signed contracts that he had with the drug company before he ever started the trials. So, yeah, there's a lot going on that you could call anything you want without exaggerating, whether it's a conspiracy or an extremely cooperative, unethical effort to promote drugs. I mean, call it what you want. It's in the extreme what goes on to promote the drugs.
And that's for sure happening. You've been a leader on exposing all that at that level of, like you say, Harvard and Dr. Biederman with their own department on this. And then you get the parent going in face-to-face, you know, in a big HMO, sitting across from the child psychiatrist. And then I think this is something I just wanted to put in this article, too, that we all, since we were children, have looked up to the doctors that cared for us, the pediatricians. I mean, we've invested this trust, and I think 90% of the time, rightfully so, in these life-saving physicians that have helped us and been there for us and our families. And so, you know, the caring mother or father goes in, and here's the child psychiatrist. And, you know, it's not like they're deferring to something that they don't trust. They trust. We trust people who with an MD behind their name. And I think that's a powerful factor in why I hear it all the time, why parents choose to give their kids or their teens these meds. You know, that, you know, they really felt like they could trust the authority of the medical doctor.
Oh, absolutely. And I imagine that if one did a survey of which doctors do you most trust, I think pediatricians would be pretty high up.
Yeah.
Because they tend to be nice people. They tend to like kids and to be interested in families. They're not like psychiatrists and being just almost uniformly now estranged, slightly weird, distant people, because they go into a profession that gives electroshock and drugs, you know, and they see it in their training. So if you're going to do that, if that's what attracts you, is locking people up, drugging them, giving them shock, you're not really your more loving, kind, open person, but really sweet human beings, you know, go into pediatrics. And
yeah,
these docs have been so misled, and they've allowed themselves to be misled. They need to take some responsibility for what they're doing.
Yeah, well, I've known a lot of child psychiatrists that are some of the nicest, like you say, sweetest people in the world. They love kids. They want to help. It's just they see it as another form of pediatrics. But I think there, again, the pressure on them through the so-called science, you know, you have guys like Jeffrey Lieberman, who was the head of the American Psychiatric Association, you know, just constantly saying, we have the science, we have the science. You know, you even have Thomas Insull now saying, we have the science. They think, you know, they have to do the applied science. And so for a child psychiatrist to reach in a drawer and pull out a brain and show it to the parent in front of a child, I worked in children's services for 15 years. I never saw that happen. So I think that's another threshold, too, you know.
Well, I think it is, but it's very, very widespread. Even though you haven't seen it, it's been going on. I haven't seen it, but it's been going on now in clinics, like this guy Iman, who have these clinics of, for years, been telling parents that, you know, he can diagnose the ADHD on the brain scans of one kind or another. So this stuff's been going on forever.
Yeah, I know. I kind of always thought that those outlying clinics, one of the famous ones, is nearby where I live. And I think the guy even says, you know, he can diagnose five different kinds of depression from looking at your MRI. And there's so much snake oil in that. But for a child psychiatrist in an HMO to now be kind of adopting that style, I think it shocked me. But what can a parent say in the face of that? Hopefully, you know, they'll find their way to someone like you or me who can present another narrative.
Yeah, absolutely. This stuff is just such a disgrace. Let me tell folks that I know people don't buy books anymore, so let me, much anyway, I have two articles that you can get on my website, Bregan.com, and look at. And one of them is this year, I guess it's probably 2016 or 15 anyway, and it's about not giving, about professionals getting together to finally say, let's call a moratorium on giving psychoactive substances to children.
Yeah.
Let's just ban it. Let's say we're not going to do that anymore. We're not going to drug kids to change their brains and their minds because of their behavior or their mental struggles. We're just going to stop doing it. We have to raise and educate kids, not drug them. And then I have an overview article that I'm also very proud of. It really gives an overview of my ideas that have evolved over decades, and it's called Rational Psychopharmacology, and it's also on my website. And if you go to the Basic Science Papers portion, there are two of the newest articles. So the stuff is laid out right there. And I've also got articles that focus on children, but the children issues are covered very well in the one where I call for the ban. The science is covered. And it's also touched on in the Rational Psychopharmacology. The data is there. And the people who give these drugs do it in defiance of science. They don't do it as scientists. They do it as arms of the psychopharmaceutical industry.
I'm so grateful to you for those books you've written and all the other books you've written over the years. I mean, I'm not an author or you know, a scientist or an MD like you, but for those of us kind of out there in working in these HMOs, working in these public mental health systems, Peter, your work has been it's almost intangible how much it's meant to us.
Just to
know that when we stand up or we question these things, that we have your authority, everything you've put together behind us. It's meant the world to me. I think a lot of the things I've been able to speak up about that are just, you know, not big books or anything, but it's just emboldened me to be able to do some of the activism I've done, to know that Peter Bregan's, I can go to your website, I can go to your books, I can hold it up and say, you know, this guy's a Harvard-trained MD with, I mean, how many books and articles, you know, it's not just me, you know. It means the world to us. There's a lot of people who, as you know, are so grateful.
Well, thank you. You know, as I get older, it means more and more to me. I almost didn't listen to praise when I was younger. And by younger, I mean into my 40s and 50s and 60s. Because I think I felt it would distract me, and I'm sort of absorbing it more now, and I deeply appreciate it. By the way, folks, I'm perfectly healthy. I have a minor cold today, and if you heard some noise earlier in the microphone, I was probably forgot myself and was chewing on a lozenger, and you might hear my voice is a little hoarse. And I apologize for the early noise. And I think the reason why I didn't even notice it when Jesse, my marvelous engineer, sent me a message was I'm just so upset about this stuff with the kids.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just hear, I'm sure, the upset in my voice talking about giving sugar-coated amphetamine candies to children. My God. So I apologize for the early noise, and I am in perfect health. Other than a slight cold, which you may be hearing in my voice today. I'm so glad to have my dear friend Michael on. And Michael Cornwall, he said he's not a writer, but he actually does write great blogs, and they're getting a lot of good attention on Madness in America, which has really been a blessing. This is Bob Whitaker's work, and it's really... been a blessing to the world to have that place for people to write and communicate, because most places are too much under the influence of the psychopharmaceutical industry to allow anything critical of drugs, because they're getting advertising, directly getting tons of advertising from them. If nothing else. Now, I've been interrupting your flow.
No.
You want to pick up on your discussion of the things that influence parents?
Well, I think we touched a little bit on, you know, the pressure that comes from schools. But the other area that I expanded on in that article that came out yesterday was how... Okay, there's the parent sitting there across from the child psychiatrist, and the standard of care is to prescribe these amphetamines.
By the way, I got to interrupt again. It is not the standard of care. It's typical practice.
Right.
The standard of care, even in the pediatric and child psychiatric textbooks, and even the stuff put out by the American Academy of Children and Adolescents, the reason I say even, because they're so heavily indebted to the drug companies and so under their influence, and almost all the people who write are, they tell you that this is not the first-line treatment, that you got to evaluate the child, you got to talk to the family, you got to get information from the teachers, you have to look at alternatives. That is the standard of care. It's okay. Just that they're totally breaching it all the time, and I think that's what you're mainly saying.
I think that's, yeah, that's what I'm saying. I wish it was that what you said, that the standard of care was that extensive kind of looking at options. But from what I've seen now, especially from my experience in that large public mental health system, where when I started in 1980, there were probably half a dozen out of the several hundred kids who were on medication. Now, I would bet money it's 98%. And it went from a whole cadre of therapists doing family therapy, doing kid teen therapy, to when NAMI and was a huge factor in coming with psychiatry and the drug companies to instill this belief in the disease model through all the system. And now there's hardly any therapists. The increase in child psychiatrists went through the roof. NAMI's campaign that came out in the 15 years ago when they shifted from just working for adults said the only person who can adequately diagnose your child is a psychiatrist. So all of us licensed professionals there who weren't psychiatrists go, what about us? We've been doing this for 20 years. So what I'm saying is now it may not be the standard of care like you say, but I'm saying it is
the standard of care, but they're not following it.
Right.
Standard of care is not what everybody's doing.
Yeah.
It's what the prudent, rational physician would do.
Yeah.
And they're not behaving like prudent, rational physicians. They're not even obeying the minimal standards of care that you will find developed in the by the FDA and the physician's desk reference and in textbooks and in scientific articles out of the establishment. The standard, I just want to help people understand because I do a lot of legal work. There's a difference between what a lot of badly behaving doctors are doing and what a standard of care is. Standard of care is not an average. The standard of care is what a prudent physician under the similar or same circumstances would do. And you find that out from not counting heads. You find that out from what are the textbooks saying, what is the diagnostic manual. Really, you can go to these insider stuff. And then, of course, you finally go to the scientific research, which is always ahead of, some of it is always ahead of the establishment's views. But if you just look at the simple standards as laid out in most places, the way 95% of the docs are behaving is way below standard in a very dangerous and unethical manner, giving out amphetamines on the first visit after a 10 or 15 minute chat with a mother. It just is not standard. It is common, though. Just want to emphasize that so people don't get confused.
I think that's super important because it shows that there are ethical and performance issues. Huge ones, and so I think what you said about the alternatives, I would hope that if these public mental health systems and other systems had real viable alternatives like the one I worked in used to, where the psychiatrist could go, you know, I'm not going to prescribe amphetamines for your child today because we have a really good resource out here where you can go get family therapy, you can go get individual therapy for your child. You know, let's do all that first before we even consider these drugs. A lot of those services don't exist anymore, I think, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, that they've really been run out of town, you know, under this whole takeover of the disease medical model. So I think that's one of the huge problems, too, is that the care that you and I would offer someone or recommend to someone of some therapy, some family therapy, some counseling, trying to address the child's problems, that way, the resources just aren't there.
They really aren't. But people can, I mean, just first of all, there's a lot of good books on raising children. There's a ton of them. Both of my books that are completely devoted to the subject of children, well, really three of them, but the Ritlin Fact Book and a couple of others, they really, talking back to Ritlin, I cite other books in them. Get your library to get them, but they're cheap paperbacks. And there are people like Howie Glasser with the nurtured child approach, the nurtured heart approach is what it's called, to children. So there are some good books out there.
Yeah.
And you can go to any library and walk through and find books and look at them that are talking about different approaches to raising kids that can be very, very helpful. And then, you know, if you're having just overwhelming problems, you could look through the various methods of Googling and looking for professionals and look for, I think, be interested in what you think about this, actually, Michael, but I think that marriage and family counselors are more likely to have a family orientation to helping children. You can call them on the phone or call a clinical psychologist or a clinical social worker and say, I'm interested in a non-drug approach. That's all I want to helping my child. Are you willing to cooperate? Would you do that? So there are resources available for helping kids. You could also look up Adlerian therapists and see if there's some in your local area, because they have very good ideas about helping children, and they tend not to want to give drugs. I talk at Adlerian Society meetings often. So there are some resources, but boy, you're right, they're hard to find.
They're hard to find, but they're sure worth looking for, and your books have been a huge resource. I know of many people who have told me that they decided not to put their kids on meds because they read some of what you'd written. So that's a powerful factor right there.
Let me make a comment about what helps kids, because it is the most complicated thing in the world. Let me get some feedback from Michael, because everybody's going to look at it a little differently. Human beings are complicated, each of us and all the people we're dealing with. But first of all, kids need a combination of, on the one hand, unconditional love. That means you never act like you've lost your love. You just always stay in touch, whether you think kids are from evolution or from God. I tend to have a very spiritual view that there's a creator. I don't know much more than that, but there's a creator who has purposes for us, and we should raise our kids as treasures. Whether you believe that or not, you certainly can find a way to just know that your children should be, as much as possible, just loved, adored. And even when you're angry that it should never be so overwhelming, or you're disappointed, it should never be so overwhelming that children don't know they're loved. So unconditional love, and then discipline. Children need to know they're not in charge. Even adolescents need to know they're not ultimately in charge. They need to know that you are the moral authority. And I talk about moral authority a lot in the Ritlin Fact Book, because it's what's missing in the wonderful parents who come to see me in a practice like mine, which is not a clinic practice. It's in, it's people who have a certain amount of success and money and insurance. And those folks are often, very well-intending, and the family is even intact or it's functioning on a reasonable level, but they don't believe in their moral authority. So they actually don't believe when they tell their child it's bedtime that the child's supposed to go up to bed. They don't believe in themselves. They don't believe their children will respond. So you got to develop some moral authority. And the only thing that I think, when you're in trouble with your kids, the only thing to enforce in any way at all is respect. So you start out, you don't go home and start out with, from a session with me, you don't go home and start out making the kids do their homework or making the kids brush their teeth. You start out saying we have a new way of being in this family that's never going to change. That is, we talk respectfully to each other. And if you're disrespectful to me, I'm not going to pay any attention to what you're saying. It isn't going to get you anything. It won't get you this. It won't get you that. It won't even get me riled. I love you, so it won't even get me riled. But I'm not going to respond to disrespectful communications. They're useless, they're worthless, they're bad. And if you see me being disrespectful, I give you permission to do something. Maybe just say, please, Mom, that hurts my feelings. Something like that. You can't be disrespectful in it. But you can hold me responsible for being respectful, and we're all going to do that in this family. And I guarantee parents, if you get that started, first of all, you will get it started if you insist on it with a child who's not yet adolescence. After adolescence, you got peer stuff, you got drugs. But the pre-adolescent child, which is often where the drugs are started, is going to respond to your insistence on respect, especially if whoever is adults in the household are on the same page. Once you have respectful communication, everything else flows. And focus in your communications beyond the respect issue on unconditional love and setting limits that you think are reasonable as a parent, just because you're the parent. What does that sound like to you? How does that sit with your view, Michael?
It sounds a lot, very much, almost identical to what I bring to the sessions I've done for about 35 years. I think that combination of really the intention to be as loving as we can with each other, you know, in our family, with our children, with our spouses, and then realizing that one of the most loving things we can do is to help the child with limits. So many parents have a hard time setting limits. Maybe they're overwhelmed. Maybe they don't want to be like their parents who were abusive and they're afraid to set any limits, or, you know, for very different reasons. They, you know, like you say, they don't quite feel up to setting limits, but it's quite a relief to children when they realize that, you know, the part of the parent expressing love is to set limits. And then that kind of egalitarian approach you said too, where the child can actually give the parent some input. One of the surprising things that I do in most family sessions I do is usually the parents come in kind of with a laundry list of what the child's doing wrong. But at some point early in the session, I said, well, let's talk about what each of you want maybe the other to do differently. And I'll turn to the child and I said, what would you like Mom and Dad to do differently? And sometimes the parents kind of go, wait a minute, we didn't come here for that, you know. But
I do that in the first session, actually. I give them a magic wand, and I have them gently tap the parent, at which point they must listen to what the child is saying. Mm-hmm. They don't have to obey, but they must listen to what the child wishes for.
and often the child then when they hear that from me, they'll kind of look and I go, really? And they'll say, well, I wish Mom or Dad would not yell at me so much or not do this. And it's really kind of remarkable what comes out, and the parents go, you know, I'm really trying to help the parents take that to heart. So the healing, if there needs healing, can be everybody gets that respect you're talking about.
You know, Michael, I think that those of us that have been doing therapy for a while, excuse me, as I said, I'm struggling with a little cold. I think that the people who've done doing therapy for a while, we're coming to a remarkable consensus. And my gosh, I hadn't thought of this before, but maybe at some point we could come up with a not very long consensus document about what helps children. Maybe you and I could start that.
I'd love to do that.
Yeah, I think that would be a real contribution. We could put it up on Med in America as a start. Let's start doing that. As usual, we're both, I'm sure, busy out of our minds. But let's just try to get it. Start with you and I put together, maybe it'll just be you and I, a consensus document. You know, I have a consensus document that I wrote and then passed by a whole number of therapists. I don't know if you were involved. There were many, which is the principles of empathic therapy that's up on the website. Yeah. I don't know if, were you involved in that process?
No, I wasn't, but I've seen that wonderful document.
Yeah, well, let's you and I, try to work up a no more than two-page consensus, our consensus, maybe we'll get two or three other people involved, document on what do children, what do, as a start, pre-adolescent children really need?
Yeah.
Because once you get to be an adolescent, then you've got to deal with other things like drugs. And we can say that, but let's do that consensus document. And maybe I'll make some notes and send it on to you. Or you make some notes and send it on to me, whoever gets to it first. So, folks,
great.
You are there. We're going to do this.
Yeah, we'll do it.
My listeners, I really am impressed, and perhaps you are too, that when therapists begin to talk together, like on my program, which is one of the few places where I think therapists get together and for a big audience and talk together, we're saying a lot of very similar things. That's good news. That's good news.
Yeah.
We got about a minute and a half left. I'm talking with Michael Cornwall. You can keep best track of him on Madden America. You just go to maddenamerica.com and plug in Michael Cornwall. And if you want to along the way, you can plug in Peter Bregan. I think Michael's been writing there a lot longer than I have. And I'll be having Michael back, you know, to talk about different things over time. Right now, shame on the FDA for approving candy-coated amphetamine. Michael, your last thoughts?
Yeah, shame on them. And there's still hope. There's still a lot of good news out there that Peter and I, we're just trying to share some of it. And There are alternatives that can really help kids, and looks like we're going to keep working on that.
Yes, we are. There's just nothing more important right now in America today than preventing the mass drugging with psychoactive substances of our children and their psychiatric diagnosing, which is giving them careers in mental health. I think it's doing more damage even than the street drugs. And since they're indistinguishable from street drugs, the amphetamines, they are street drugs, they're pushing street drugs. Thank you so much, Michael Cornwall.
Thank you, Peter. Thank you.